We are still working with the idea of the narrative of Unitarian Universalism, and is the way that we present our narrative to ourselves, to our community, and to the outside world, does the story of who we are and how we present that, is it strong enough to contain and hold the anxieties of today? There has been concern in our community and in the leadership on the national level and regional and district level that our numbers are dwindling and concern about our future. And I know that we human beings, we make meaning out of story, and story holds our identities together, and story holds our communities together. And if there's something going on with our community in which we are either fragmenting or shrinking, then it has something to do with how we hold our stories and our imagination and how we tell our stories to ourselves, to one another, and to the culture at large. And I know that the history of Unitarian Universalism, the actual events of our faith tradition, is indeed strong enough to hold the anxieties of today. And as a matter of fact, our history has given birth to the qualities of our nation of equality, separation of church and state, democracy, that actually create a larger narrative that encourages and promotes liberty and freedom of conscience and thought and dialogue. And so we ask ourselves, how could we contribute to the larger narrative that can hold a nation together, but somehow we lost how we express that narrative, that some of the community that has promoted the origins of those narrative is shrinking and getting smaller? For indeed it is our narrative that is the foundation of this nation and the foundation of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. We can trace that back 500 years, and we know that to be true. And yet, at the same time, we are anxious about who we are as a people and carrying our story forth. And what happens when the originators of some thoughts that we value so much in this nation, what happens when that voice gets smaller and smaller? That's the question we are dealing with today. And kind of on a lighter note, I suppose, we'll change a bit. I was looking at on the internet this morning, looking for material for the sermon. No, educating myself. I just thought, looked at some stories and recognized that we do live in kind of a crazy world. We do. I think it was in one of the states in the West. There were seven men who were praying on a parking lot, and they were arrested and detained, because they were kind of gathering, and it wasn't Christian prayer, so it was a problem. It's crazy making. And then there's another story about a person who reached into a bear cage and was feeding bears and got their fingers bitten off, and they said alcohol was involved. You know, crazy, man. The bear was saying, good. The bear was saying, you know, and then further, I was listening to Barney Franks talking about how during the Cold War, what an odd name, the Cold War, that we had a three-pronged military strategy to deal with the Soviet Union to make sure that we wouldn't lose the Cold War. And that's certainly coming under question, isn't it? But anyway, to make sure that we wouldn't lose the Cold War, and the three-pronged things, submarines, warships, and stealth bombers, and those kind of things. And he said that now they no longer exist in the same way. The Cold War no longer exists, but yet we're still promoting and forming a military to fight a country and a war that no longer exists. That's crazy. A fantasy character in our imagination. And he's making the point, when we talk about healthcare, we talk about money, we talk about building a military apparatus to fight an enemy that no longer exists, and nobody says a word. And it's the first time I've heard in this discussion about healthcare somebody talking about taking some of the money that we spend on military. The first time I've heard that, and use it to support the domestic policy. Interesting thought. And we know, if any of you have read Chalmers Johnson's book, Nemesis, it talks about two kingdoms, the Roman Empire and the British Empire, and the Roman Empire, toward the end of the empire, decided not to invest in its domestic sphere, but continued to invest in its military sphere, and eventually had to turn into a fascist state and eventually collapsed. Whereas at the Second World War, the British Empire gave up its colonization process and its imperialistic and decided to invest its money into the domestic sphere and continue to be a nation. It's a crazy, crazy world. And then I learned, and we value the separation of church and state so much. I don't know if one I ever, have ever heard of the dynamic of discovery coming from the Catholic Church in the 14 and 1500s, and it's the principle of discovery. If you discover something that's not Christian, people, and it don't matter, you get to own it. The principle of discovery, church principle, right? And so in 1835, the Supreme Court, our Supreme Court, incorporated that into our civil law. That if we discover something, we can own it. And I never thought about it like that before. But in a sense, we've carried on the church's imperialism right into our Supreme Court, right into our civil law, right into what we have, at least as a junior high student, I don't know where you were in junior high, Manifest Destiny was a proud thing, a good thing. But I didn't realize that Manifest Destiny was actually originated in the Catholic Church, incorporated into our law in 1835, and made civil. I mean, it's when you learn history, it's a crazy world. Sometimes it's crazy making, sometimes it's so when I look at our history as Unitarian Universalists, I was talking to a friend about this sermon, and he said that, what are you asking us to become Christian again? And I said, no, I'm just talking about our history to know where we've come from. But even in talking to this fairly neutral dialogue, when I brought up that what I'm going to bring up right now, this person felt threatened that I was trying to say we need to go back in time and become who we once were and not just claim our history and what has given us strength. And when I look at the our principles, and when we've been talking about Michael Servetus, we've been talking about Francis Davin, and look at that, and Emerson and Thoreau and Margaret Fuller, and the formation of who we are as Unitarian Universalists, those values come from people's dedication to studying the Bible and their dedication to their Christian life. That's just true. And because we simply say that this is part of our history, not to claim it, I think it's problematic. It is where we come from. And a universalist in 1945 said in order to be universalist, we've got to broaden our spectrum beyond the Christian boundaries and claim more. And I think that's important for us to do that. And we look at Servetus and we look at Francis Davin, the people who were martyred in our history. And they were certainly taking the traditional Christian view that wasn't traditional at that point, but the Catholics, Calvin and Luther, and they were going further with it. But nonetheless, they had this spiritual drive. So I come across this article that talks about, in a sense, I guess the title could be, you know, what is with Christianity today? What is going on? And he says that over 25% of the American population is fundamentalist and evangelical Christians, and who value and state that the Bible is the place of their values come from. And so the guy writing this, a professor, He says that he asked his class to read a book called Mountains Beyond Mountains, and it was about a Dr. Paul Farmer who's been in Haiti for years combating AIDS and TB, and he's a practicing Catholic man, and he had given up a medical practice in this country, which could have been profitable, and he went down. And so he's got his, in Messiah College, his Christian students reading this book as an example of Christ-like example. And so this one student comes up and says, this book is inappropriate for this college because he wasn't a Christian. And so the professor says, what? Shocked. What are you talking about? He wasn't a Christian. So he pushed the student a bit further, and she says, well, he never preached the gospel. He never led people to Jesus. He didn't use the language that we know you have to use in order to be a Christian. And the professor is just, what? What are you talking? You know, and so I'm thinking, okay, here's a man doing the gospel. And we talked last week about the rich young ruler not giving up his goods. And here's a man who gave up his wealth to do the gospel. That's not good enough. To do the gospel, you have to speak particular words, and then he talks about and he goes on further talking about how the in the Torah, the Old Testament and the New Testament, there's a preference for the poor, there's a preference for justice, there's a teaching that says love your enemies, and whenever I hear that from now on, and this is just how my mind works, and I know other people's minds work differently, you know, I see religious leaders, and then President Bush, I guess it was the Episcopal Cathedral in Washington, after 9/11, and getting up there and essentially calling for revenge, if I'm not interpreting that right, or calling for aggressiveness. And I'm reading this teaching that these people come from that we're supporting this aggressive nature that says, love your enemies. And trying to make sense out of that. And moving in the direction of a sense of peace over conflict. And having that as a solid, central principle. And then I look at our history, and I see in the... I don't know if any of you have ever read... Let me... Universalists in 1917, the Universalist Church, came out with a statement. And their statement goes like this. Charles Skinner, if any of you remember him... He was part of this, and it was a Declaration of Social Principles at the Universalist General Conference Convention in 1917. The Universalist Church recognizes the fact that no individual, no nation, can live a completely effective Christian life in an unchristian social order. Now, when I hear that after the past 30 years, my red flags are going up. What are you talking about, a Christian social order in a Christian nation? Because we've been doing that, and we've been on a crusade, and in the name of Jesus, in the name of Christ, in the name of Christianity, we've got this discovery doctrine in the DNA of our national structure, at least since 1835, that gives us permission, anything that's not us, we can do what we want with. So when I read this, when I first started reading it, I says, oh no, how am I going to talk about this? And so he goes on to say that we therefore declare the primal task of the church today is to be the reconstruction of the world's civilization in terms of justice, in terms of peace and righteousness, so that the spiritual life of all may develop to its fullest capacity. You cannot have a classist society. You cannot have a society where some are privileged and some are not. You cannot have a society where a group of people, and I think in the book of Isaiah it says it so beautifully, you cannot have a nation where the people of wealth in the middle of the night make plans to take advantage of the widows and the orphans and to steal their houses. That's literally what it says. You cannot have that way of life, that kind of economic structure with this principle, so that the spiritual life of all may develop to its fullest capacity. You can't have a class in society, a privileged few, and have a value of developing the spiritual capacity of all citizens. And grandiose statement. The Universalist Church, us, our heritage, our history, the Universalist Church offers a complete program for completing humanity. Oh my God. what in the world, you know? Religious preachers and leaders that we do get, it's beyond pontificating. You know? We're going to complete humanity. However, the first principle of the completion of this humanity, the first principle, an economic order which shall give to every human being an equal share in the common gifts of God, and in addition, all that we shall earn, all that he shall or she shall earn by his own labor. Now, when I read that, I said, this guy's read Marx. Because you do your labor, but somebody else gets what you earn, and you get a portion. But this says, oh, I don't know how that works. But that's part of the Universalist, part of our faith tradition, part of who we are as a people. An economic order which shall give to every human being a share in the common gifts of God, the common gifts of this planet. Does that mean that if we have a nation, that if there's gold in South Dakota, and there's gold in San Francisco, and there's silver over there, and there's copper over there, and there's fruit over there, and there's plants over there, that everyone in the nation should share of that wealth? Somehow? That makes sense to me as a Universalist. A social order in which there shall be equal rights for all, special privilege for none. The help of the strong for the weak until the weak become strong. That's us. These are words from our faith ancestors. This is who we are as a people. That we would take on the obligation and the responsibility that if we have any power, economic, intellectual, physical, whatever power we have, whatever strengths we have, one of the first obligations we have is to look around this world and say, is there somebody that needs help? Is there somebody weaker? Is there somebody that needs to be driven to the airport? Is there somebody that needs a patio? Is there somebody that needs a ditch dug so they can run city water so they don't have to pay for it? I don't know. Is there somebody that needs help thinking through a crisis? You know, I'm thinking of there's news that the shuttle program is going to close. And the last shuttle, you know, I'm starting to pray. President Obama, how about some of that stimulus money shoveled into that shuttle program, right?
He did.
Yes. Good. So then the fear was, and maybe this is not a fear anymore, so I'll check that out. The fear was in the community that as that filters through, 23,000 jobs are going to be lost. From the space shuttle to the people who deliver pizza, the whole spectrum, private school, I don't know, from the whole spectrum. And then we know for a fact that when factories leave towns and go, we know when business leaves communities, we know beyond a shadow of a doubt, divorces increase, addictions increase, child abuse increase, domestic violence increase. We know that. We know that. Beyond a shadow of a doubt. And because we know that, if these are our principles, do we have intellectual strength and wisdom? Do we have any kind of resources that might be helpful to those people that are going to go through that kind of trauma that we can already start that program to look at that, to talk about it? How many people go through marital crisis, family crisis, but can't afford consultation or a counselor? And do we have that kind of wisdom in this church? And yes, we do have that kind of wisdom in this church. And how do we make it available? these principles, these values say, if you don't know how to make that available, you find out how to make that available. You do that. We have an identity of who we are as a people. We have an identity of who we are as individuals. We have an identity of who we are as partners with one another and people that we love. We are in a faith tradition that it is part of our tradition to evolve beyond identities. If that makes sense. We have a faith tradition that says, you know, I've got my life right now set up, and part of my identity is who I am. I speak from this pulpit on a regular basis, and I do things in my life, kayak, fish, paint, walk, you know, engage Scrabble, fight over Scrabble, you know, so we have an identity. Okay. So when I read this, it is a challenge to change my identity. It is a challenge to change who I am if I'm not already doing it. It is a challenge that I may be doing this in my life, but if we have skills, wisdom, talents, strengths, and there are other people out there who are struggling, and if I have to figure out and get with a group of people in the church and figure out a way to challenge those strengths to those people who are struggling, that may mean I have to change something over here, then that means my identity changes. That means who I'm going to be and who I am in this world changes. And that is not easy. I can remember on numerous occasions as a counselor, especially with couples, and I suspect if this touches any of you out there, don't go home and fight about it. And one or the other of the person will say, and obviously if a couple makes it to a counselor's office, they've had troubles. Sometimes one has been drugged, and sometimes not drugged to get there, but drugged. But whatever it takes. I'll hear this. This is the way I am. This is the way I've been. Take it or leave it, periodically. This is a person who is locked into an identity, getting feedback from somebody they care about, somebody that loves them and somebody that they love, saying there's something going on and we need to change. We need to do something different. This isn't working anymore. This isn't helpful anymore. I'm suffering, or whatever, however that might be. And the other person says, in essence, too bad, I don't care, this is the way I am, this is it, this is what you get. And when I was writing that, taking that notes down, and I'm pretty sure that the it word is almost verbatim, you know, take it or leave it. Which means if I'm saying that, I'm with something, and I say, well, you either take it or leave it, the it's referring to me. Right? Take it or leave it. That's me. I'm objectifying myself as an object, as an it. I'm not a thou. I'm not in dialogue. I'm not available for transformation. I'm not available for change. I'm an it. I'm a thing. I'm an object. I'm locked into place. I can't change. We get there. And we get there generally. We get there out of fear. If I can't make the changes that I'm hearing feedback from, or that there's a voice in me that says, yeah, this would be good to do, if I can't make the changes and I can't begin that transformation process, usually it's out of some fear.
confusion. You hear the term the fear of intimacy. You ever heard that term, the fear of intimacy? The fear of closeness. You think about it, we want to drive toward intimacy. We want to drive toward closeness, but yet we have this fear. In that case, usually if I refer to myself as an it and I lock myself in, it has usually become some problems in history and I'm no longer available to be emotionally closer or emotionally changed from where I am now. And I'm saying that the same thing happens for a community and the same thing happens for a spiritual group of people. That when we read in our history that these are our faith values, and the people in our history adopted those faith values, lived out those faith values, and passed those faith values on to the next generation, and that's how we got here in this room. That's how come we're here. If we get locked in and we say we're comfortable and we're not going to change, then we have adopted the philosophy and the practice of spiritual traditions that say all truths and absolute truths are from history, they're not negotiable, and this is who we are, and this is right or wrong, and we're still going to build that stealth airplane rather than take that money and put it into healthcare because this is who we are as a people. I'm sitting in the council. This is who I am as a person, and this take it or leave it. We're a spiritual community. We're not going to change. We're okay of who we are. Even though when I read in our history that our spiritual values came from a Christian tradition, sometimes in my mind let me immediately put that aside. But then I think, wait a minute, if it's coming from a spiritual tradition and 25% of the people at least claim their values and we see the opposite happening, is our spirituality the shadow side of Christianity? I don't know how that works. But if I get locked in and I don't pull the messages from my history in and understand them and work with them and allow them in a way to have their way with me, not lock in that I'm locked into that past, but to inform me and give me insight of how to be in the future, then I will lose touch with that value from our universalist tradition that says that the strong will help the weak until they are strong. And I'm not willing to let that go. That is at the heart of who we are as a people. It is at the heart of most major religious traditions. The strong will help the weak. If we have an intellectual wisdom, an educational wisdom, we have physical strength, the strong will help the weak until they become strong. If the Unitarian Universalists have a call today, and if we are going to change, we need to pay attention to the strong helping the weak until they are strong. We need to pay attention to that and grapple with that and try to figure out what that means. And if I'm under the definition of weak, then I need to get enough strength to ask for help. To let people know I'm struggling and that I need help. And we need people who are strong to have the wisdom to see difficulties that might be there. We need to be willing to shift our identities, face those fears, and make the changes we need to make to serve this community in this room and in the larger community. And if we do that, I think the Unitarian Universalist movement will take care of itself. We will become who we are, a caring and a compassionate people.
Questions, comments?
This time in our service, it is our custom to have dialogue or clarification about the sermon or things said, and you're certainly welcome to do that. On occasion, debate.
It's interesting. I do want to mention one thing. You say
It's logical that we want to stop building these warplanes that aren't necessary, is what they were determined in the past, and healthcare. But you mentioned also that we'd like to see NASA continue on so we don't lose jobs. Well, if you take money away from building for the military, you're going to end jobs in a different city. You could think about that, too.
And where we lose is when we get locked in to we can't do this because of the jobs. And when a group says, yes, you got to, no, you don't. What happens, there is no space in between to talk creatively about how to make that transformation difference through time. We talk in our nation... For example, when Jimmy Carter gave his, in 1977, his speech about the oil embargo and not buying any more oil than we've already buying, and if we're going to use more energy, we're going to make energy on our own, and it's going to be tough. Well, we got rid of him and got somebody in and said it was going to be easy, and we can do it, right? Is that what we did? That's what we did. But Brazil didn't do that. And I'm not saying Brazil with their, sawgrass, had all the answers, but they began a program that would take gradual change through the years. This is not what we're good at. We're not good at that. And many of us who have made a life plan of 10 years, of 5 years, and have accomplished goals, we know that you have to have a vision, and you have to say, through the difficult times, through the lean times. I can remember doing one chapel, an internship. I had to give up my insurance. I had to give up a car. I had to ride the bus back and forth. But in order to do that internship to get where I wanted to go, I had to do that. It doesn't seem to me as a nation we're willing to do that. And so when we talk about these different programs that are going to change, what we need to do is engage a dialogue of somebody having a vision and a transformational process that makes sense. Yeah. That's what we're missing. But that was a good point that I'm saying save one, get rid of the other. Yeah, because one's closer to home. But one's not necessarily military either. So.
What you began with, it's a crazy world. I could write volumes on that. It is a crazy world. The Wall Street Journal had a poll about the Space Center and the space program, why should we do it? And I think 5 people answered that poll. And most of them lived on Merritt Island, and so you know where they worked. They worked at the Space Center. And all they said was, well, I pay taxes here, I got to support my family, that. It's going to break the bank, but not one of them said, what is it good for? So all of what they were talking about financial. And I still don't know what it's good for. Does anybody know what it's good for?
Yeah.
What?
I worked for, I produced a product that NASA used. To look at outer space in order to try and find life out there, to see if we'll ever have experience. You know, that's one thing, is there life out there?
Well, it's also curiosity, part of the human need is to be curious and do that. What we're talking about is not doing that at the expense of other people being hungry. And somehow finding some kind of balance in that, you know, some people make this much money, some people don't make a living wage, and figuring out how to balance that out so that all needs are met and so that all resources are in some way are shared. And so that's what we're talking about, and how we make a transition from one to the other. We at least got to engage in that dialogue and talk about it, and I think that's where Unitarian Universalism can grow and can contribute to our culture just by saying, wait a minute, and even when we talk to evangelicals who talk about a certain particular language, if we are
care enough to know part of our own tradition, the Bible, and part of what we know other people value the Bible, we can say, well, we're talking war. Well, what about the value of love your enemies? What does that mean? We can engage in that middle, we can create that space and engage that dialogue. Well, what does it mean feed the poor? What does it mean when you were thirsty and hungry and naked, we clothed you, gave you something to drink? What does that mean when poverty is increasing and we've got this particular power structure in place? If we care enough, we can get into that dialogue and we can create space for that dialogue, but we need to know our history and we also need to know the values of the people we're talking to. And I think Unitarian Universalism can step in that gap and create that dialogue. And we have historically. It's really been who we are.